was Mal and I's a gathering.
And there was a comedian that lived in this area and is buried here called Brother Dave Gardner. And one of Brother Dave's sayings was, tell me something you believe in, because I got enough damn doubts of my own. And I believe with the lineup of speakers we've got this weekend, if we listen, we're going to hear some things that we can believe in. I asked C.D. if it was all right if I introduced him as C.D. Collins, because it might be a little awkward to introduce him as CDC. Since we got that thing downtown Atlanta, you know, the Center for Disease Control, that they refer to as CDC, and he said he would be all right. CD's one of those old World War II airplane pilots, and that's a hobby of mine, is old airplanes. And one of the things they used to talk about, to tell me, Don Roberts and Speedy and others, that you had to watch those gauges, you see, and as long as that needle was just barely in the green, you could fly and everything would be all right. So, Pat's over here saying, remember, the chairman chairs and the speaker speaks. So, without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you, from Statesboro, Georgia, sober and clean, C.D. Collins, and he's keeping it in the green. Thank you. This is still like a blind combat to me, as much as I do that. I never get used to it. Blind combat, every time I get ready to go up, I'd always have something to drink, but it was always liquor, not Coca-Cola. I'm drinking Coke now, thank God again, because that's the reason I'm here today. It's quite an honor to be asked to talk up here, because believe it or not, and I hope I can get into some of it, and I hope this sound system will work where you can pick it up, because I've got a message that was passed on to me by people like you that I want to pass on to someone else. Thank the committee for asking me. I'm very honored to be here. And believe it or not, here about 37 years ago is where it all went to hell on me and Ida. This lady sitting on my left, who I love very dearly, had jet black hair and it was long and hung down to her waist. Yeah, there was a time when this lady started to blow my brains out by reason something happened as a result of drinking liquor. And she's a beautiful lady today, and I love her very dearly. But 37 years ago in the town of Marietta, Georgia, we lived on Waterman. And then right out of Waterman. And she told me goodbye one morning and took me to the office to go to work. And the next thing I heard from this lady was from her attorney. And they were suing for divorce. She was. And everything went out of the drain as a result of drinking liquor. And I want to tell you a little bit about my drinking, about what happened to me, what it used to be like, what it is like today. I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I don't know how y'all feel, but I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. But about 37 years ago, everything went down the tube for me and Ida, and as a result of divorce, I lost literally everything in the world that meant anything to me. But I had Dobbins Air Force Base. I started flying jets out there in 1949. I look back on it a long time. I think I had a legitimate reason to drink. I don't know about y'all, but a fellow that's put in a jet aircraft that's never been in one in his entire life. Never been in a jet airplane. Didn't have any two-seaters at that time, and they put me in an airplane, an F-84 out here. Told me it's time for me to fly, and they struck a match and lit the damn fire and let me go. And I never will forget it as long as I live, what a traumatic experience it was. To get in an airplane where I've been used to riding in one that had a great big radial engine, four-bladed prop, weighed 7.5 tons. I get in one that's got a hole down through the middle of it, and they build a fire in it. And that's one hell of a traumatic experience to a human being that's never been in one in his life. So I think maybe I had a legitimate reason to drink. I don't know if some of you did or not. I think I did. I was not born an alcoholic. I know that. I became an alcoholic through using alcohol over a long period of time. I was born down in Southeast Georgia, and my folks were primitive Baptists of faith. I don't know if y'all know about the old line primitive Baptists, but that's what my mother was and father was. And I went to church and Sunday school and prayer meeting every time the doors of the church opened. And any of y'all that know anything about the old line primitive Baptists, they preach hell, fire, and damnation. You know, and I never will forget this as long as I live, because it impressed me so much growing up as a young boy. And the preacher would get up and get preaching about, you know, the things that you've done. And they had one in there that said, if you think about committing a sin, then you have committed it, you know. Now, that blew my mind. I got to be about 13 years of age, and I began to think about some things. And I thought, oh, God, I'm going to hell, you know, and I'm going to burn in hell forever. So I might as well do some of it. So I began to try to do some of it. And by the way, ladies, you're the reason I drank liquor, really. Women called me to drink liquor. The first drink I ever had in my life was given to me by a lady at a beer joint. I come out of this beer joint between Lyles and Vidalia. And this lady saw me and says, come here, son, you look like a kid. Have you ever drank any liquor? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, would you like a drink? I said, yes, ma'am. She had a half a pint of Old Quaker. Some of y'all don't even remember that liquor. It's been so long. Old Quaker, sitting up on a tray on the side of the car. He opened the half a pint, poured it in two glasses. One half in one glass, one half in another glass. She took her glass, turned up and drank it, handed me the other. And I turned it up and drank that half of a half a pint. And I walked about 100 yards and fell just like you'd shot me with a 30-30. And things began to come out of all parts of my body. I'm telling you what the truth is. The biggest experience I've had in my life. And if anybody had any sense, that would have wound it up. But not with me. You know, you ladies were drinking. I thought I ought to be able to do it too. And I worked like the devil. I don't think anybody, maybe y'all do. I don't think anybody happened to be an alcoholic. God knows. You had to work like hell to be an alcoholic. You can't just take it easy. You got to work at it. We've had a lot of people come into AA in Statesboro, Georgia, said, we'd like to join, you know. Said, well, you got to go drink some liquor. Said, well, I don't like drink. Well, you got to work at it. You know, you really got to put some effort into doing this thing. We think in Statesboro, it's the AA capital of the world. I don't know when y'all ever been to Statesboro, Georgia. Georgia Southern University down there now. It's a town of 18,000 people. We have five AA groups in a town of 18,000 people. We have 65 meetings a week in that town. 18,000 people. It's a status symbol of belonging to AA in Statesboro. More than it is the country club or the Rotary Club. It's belonging to AA. You know. We've had a lot of people come down and want to join and say, go drink some liquor and come back and present your credentials and we'll see if we'll let you in, you know, that kind of a deal like that. Anyway, I'm very serious about it. We have a world of people now, and we have some young people in our group from 13 years of age right on up to my age. I've been around a long time. Let me see here now. I came on the scene and sobered up October the 21st, 1957. So you figure that out. I've been sober for 33 years, so only 34 years. And I am a drunk who went completely down the tube into alcoholism. I went lost everything in the world that meant anything to me. As a result of drinking liquor. Am I too close or too far? Getting a lot of feedback now. That thing quiet down a little and let me talk. Well, maybe I talk a little low. I don't know. I don't want you to miss some of this stuff I'm coming out with because I think it's the keys to what happened to me. I began to drink this stuff and I worked real hard at it, trying to become a good drinker as such. My lovely wife over here on my left. Can y'all hear me now? Can all of you hear me in the back here? Huh? All right. Why don't we leave the thing off then? So this is going to be, I'm a mover. I like to move around and wave my arms and jump up and down the whole bit, you know. This beautiful lady here on my left over here, the lady who had the long black hair, and I. Can you hear me? All right. Can you hear me now? Okay, all right, that's good. The lady that I met when I was a senior in high school, I dated her for 5 years and married her after 5 years. Married her while I was up here in law school in Atlanta, Georgia. Married my senior year. And everybody told us we shouldn't get married. And they were right, by the way. My family didn't want me to marry her, and her family didn't want her to marry me. It was one of them deals where nobody wants to get married, and they were right, by the way. But we shouldn't have gotten married, but we did anyway. And I went into World War II, became a fighter pilot, through the old P-40, the Warhawk, early part of war, the P-47 during the war, came out of service, went to work for the federal government downtown in the Belle Isle building. Some of y'all old enough to remember the Belle Isle building downtown Atlanta. Went to work down there for the Veterans Administration, working as an adjudicator. Handling claims against the government. Worked and flew out here at Dobbins Air Force Base. Stayed in the National Guard and continued to fly the airplanes. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Used to fly around the countryside every weekend. And flying those P-47 and having a big time. We'd go to Jacksonville, we'd go to Dallas, we'd go to Washington, we'd go all these different places. And had a ball, a bunch of old fire pilots. And drank a lot of liquor. And I was always weathering in. I'd weather in at different places, you know. And I'd call Ida back from these places where I had weathered in. And one time I weathered in Washington, D.C., and I called out and told her, the weather's bad. I can't take off. She said, don't take off the ground. The weather's bad. Stay up there. And old Dick Barrett's wife was over at my house, and she's one of these smart gals, you know, a smart person. So she said, let's call the weather office and see what the weather is in Washington, D.C. So she gets on the phone and calls the weather office over at Dobbins Air Force Base and says, what's the weather in Washington, D.C.? He said, the weather's clear and the visibility is unlimited. Beautiful day in Washington, D.C. I come dragging back on Tuesday. And I confronted me with this information they had acquired from the weather office. I said, listen, Isla, you can't find out what the weather is in Washington. It's top secret. And if you call any more checking on me, you're going to get me in a damn lot of trouble because I'm flying these highly classified missions, you know. So I don't know about y'all, but I learned to lie real well. I was a chronic liar. I learned to lie. When I got in there, I had a time stopping line. I don't know what y'all did not. I said, where you been? I said, filling station, when I've been to the drugstore. You know, I just lied. Built right. So I began to try to stop lying. It took me a long time to stop lying after I got sober because it's built right into the system. As I said, I started flying jets in 1949. I was called back on active duty in the Korean conflict in 1950 as a jet fighter pilot. Some of you guys in here had several pilots, other pilots from Merritt. I hope some of you are here that went back on that deal. Anyway, I went back on this deal, and we wound up, out and I did, up at Fort Bragg, Fayetteville, North Carolina, attached to TAC headquarters and going around putting on demonstrations showing the Army what the jet aircraft could do and all this type of stuff. And I was assigned to a colonel over there by the name of Douglas. He retired as a general, and we ran into him a couple years ago out in Little Rock. And he's not an alcoholic, but he loved liquor better than anybody in the world. And I was assigned to him, and we flew around the countryside putting on these demonstrations, Douglas and I did. Had a ball, you know. And I got orders to go overseas because they needed jet fighter pilots real bad, and so I was going to have to go. And Douglas gave Ida and I a farewell party at his home before we were going up to Langley Field to leave to go in the Korean conflict. I was. He gave one of these big, and if any of y'all have been around fighter pilots, that's the craziest bunch of people you can ever get around. They're nuts. He gave us a big party at his home, and everybody over there drunk, throwing the wives in the pool, and chasing each other, and just raising sand in general, having a ball. And Douglas came over to me about 4 o'clock in the morning and said, Collins, can you fly a B-25? I said, I'm the best B-25 pilot you've ever seen. Now, when I'm drunk, I think I can fly anything. I don't know about y'all. He said, would you take me down to Columbus, Georgia in the morning? I said, be glad to. I'd overheard the conversation. She came and said, honey, you can't fly no B-25. You're a fighter pilot. I said, he's drunk and I'm drunk. Forget it. And the party broke up by daylight. We went home on the base. Got in the house and started getting undressed. And the colonel drove up across the lawn in a big Cadillac and blowed the horn on. Let's go! Put on a uniform, staggered out the door when I got in this big Cadillac, and we drove down the flight line at Pope Air Force Base on Bragg. As we pulled up in front of operations to park, I looked right out in front of operations, and there sat a B-25. Now, I knew what a B-25 looked like. I taxied by them all over the country. There was one parked out there. Colonel went in and filled out a clearance, and the sergeant come up, saluted the colonel, said, the aircraft's ready to go. Fine. So we started staggering out towards the airplane. I thought we was playing a game. You know, we got staggered out towards the airplane, me and the sergeant, the colonel. We got out, and I got out, as I said, I'd never been a B-25 in my life. And as the ladder comes down between the main gear on a B-25, you crawl up right through the belly of it. And we got out, and this ladder's down. The colonel said, you go. I said, no, you go. I thought we were playing a game. I thought any minute it'd break up, we'd go back to the officer club and drink some liquor. He said, no, you go. And I said, okay. So I crawl up through the belly of it, sit down on the seat. It's a VIP airplane, been flushed up. I sit down on the seat. And the colonel come up through the belly of the thing. He said, get up front and let's go. I thought, well, this is as far as I'm going with this deal. I said, listen, Douglas, I didn't call him, colonel. I said, I can't fly no B-25. He said, hell, you said you could. Let's go. I thought the sergeant was going to faint. He turned white as a sheet, you know. And if I'd have been him, I'd have walked off from that deal right there. Because me and the colonel both drunk as a cooter, you know, and the sergeant's cold sober. I said, sergeant, can you crank it up? He said, yes. I said, get in the right seat and crank it up. He got in the right seat, buckled in and cranked it up. The colonel lay down on the back seat and passed out, and I got in the left seat and buckled up. Sergeant got both engines running. I looked around. There's a maze of instruments on the B-25. Some of them I recognized, some of them didn't. You know, some of them were okay. I said, where did the fuel go? He said, all feeds into one main tank. You draw off the main. I said, fine. I called a tower for taxi instructions. They cleared me out at the end of the back to the runway. I got out there, and I thought there ought to be a lot to check in a B-25. It isn't a fighter, but I couldn't think of anything to check in at 25. So I caught the brakes with my toes. Pushed the throttles all the way forward, and everything went up into the green, as we say in the Air Force. And if everything goes up into the green, that means it ought to go. It all went up in the green, so it ought to go. I called a tower, and it cleared me out on the active runway, that B-25. And I poured the colder, and down the runway I go. And about halfway down the runway, the thought occurred to me, this is a hell of a way to die. I wasn't even excited about it. It's a hell of a way to die. You know? I pulled it in the air, and the sergeant cleaned it up, as we said. He knew how to get the gear up, and the flaps up, and all this stuff. And he pulled it all up, got it, everything cleaned up, and I headed out for Lawson Field. about an hour out of Fort Bragg. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you'll understand the next remark. Liquor died out. And panic set in, just like that. We're going through there at 10,000 feet. I'm in the left seat where the pilot's supposed to be, and there's a sergeant in the right seat, and a colonel passed out on the back. Three people on board, nobody could fly the damn airplane. Now, if you don't think that'll give you a thrill, you think about it, you know. And I got terribly disturbed, to put it mildly. I got upset about the whole deal. And I realized that I was the pilot. I was in the left seat, and I was where the pilot is. I told the sergeant, I said, go back and get that colonel up and get him up here to help me land this damn thing. I didn't know how I was going to get it on the ground. He went back and tried to wake the colonel up. The colonel wouldn't get up. He come up front, pulled up my headset. And he said, the colonel said, come in over in the runway at about 125 miles an hour, chop the power, and it should land, you know. And that's exactly what I did. And I chopped the power down at Lawson Field at Columbus, Georgia. Went in officers' club and had three double martinis and flew the damn thing back. That's insanity, any way you take it. That's crazy. I don't care what you say. That's nutty to fruitcake. I don't know, I went on up to Langley Field. I was pregnant. Every time she got pregnant, I wound up going overseas. She was pregnant at the time, and I wound up going to Japan, Fukuoka. I tossed it out because every now and then there's somebody in one of these rooms, it was there. Went to Fukuoka down to Izuzuki Air Force Base. All went out, all a bunch of old World War II fighter pilots. Some of them had children, a whole bit. All got down there. And I got down there, and I wasn't enthusiastic about fighting like World War II. I wasn't all keyed up about all that. I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to die and nothing else. We left the States with 75 pilots a wing. We got down there and began to fly. And I never will forget this as long as I live, because I don't remember it real well. One of the first guys that was killed was a guy that married just before we left Langley Field, and his wife was pregnant at the time, and he was killed. We left the States with 75 pilots, ladies and gentlemen. I have some feelings about this right on. We killed 38 of them in the first 7 months I was over there. Old World War II boys. I got over there, and I didn't want to fight, and I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to be there. And I began to drink liquor now because I needed to drink. We carried a flight surgeon with us. That's four nurses. Never forget this as long as I live, you know. I tried to get grounded. I couldn't get grounded. I never forget this. I went and talked to the flight surgeon. I said, how can I get grounded? I'm not happy with the situation. He said, well, if you're gay, we'll ground you. I said, I'm gay. He said, well, we've got to catch you in the act before we ground you. I said, well, you know. So I didn't get grounded at all on that deal at all. So I continued to fly there. And most of you who were in the military in World War II, especially in the Korean conflict, the government issued 2 ounces of permission of alcohol to all flying personnel. If you flew in combat, you got 2 ounces of permission furnished for the government. A lot of people don't know it. A lot of people don't know in World War II that they furnished us pills to take, you know, speed to take, where you're coming back after a long mission, you pop a couple of them pills to kind of pick you up, you know, where you get the thing back on the ground, you know. A lot of people don't even know this, but they furnished us 200 permission flown, and in all briefing rooms, all of y'all have seen this, where you go in a briefing room, all the doors are closed, you come in by all this coffee, go sit down in the briefing room, and the briefing officer gets up and pulls down the map, takes his pointer and tells you where you're going, what you're going to do, and what ordnance you have. We're sitting there with our pads writing all this down on our knees, where we're going, what we're going to do. Always his closing remarks in all briefings is this. Now, if you get shot down, here's what you do. And that would upset me so bad I couldn't hardly sit there. So instead of coming out and drinking coffee, I'd drink another double shot of bourbon. I'd already had five drinks before I got out. I'd take another double shot. I'd get in that F-84 and go north into Korea and drop those 2 1,000-pound bombs and get rid of that napalm and get rid of those rockets and try to stay alive. I lied a lot about what all I shot down, what all I shot up. And ladies and gentlemen, I didn't shoot down nothing unless he got in my way of me getting home. That's the only people I shot at. So a lot of people get killed up there. My old CD just tried to stay alive, to be honest about it all. I went through an awful lot of turmoil in this particular deal at all. Had a terrible time up there in combat at the particular time I went through. And I began to drink liquor because I needed to drink it. One day I thought, well, I'm going to try to fly one day without drinking. As I was taxiing out, I began to throw up over the side of the aircraft. I began to vomit, and the tower saw me throwing up, and they made me come back and park my airplane. Because I was sick, and I never attempted to fly anymore without drinking. I flew every mission on the influence of liquor. Every mission I flew out of it was wired up. You know, it's an amazing thing about what it'll do for you, alcohol in combat. Let me tell you about an incident that occurred. I met a Catholic priest over there named Father Ford from Boston, Massachusetts. I understand today he's in the AA program. Somebody said he was, and I hope the heck I run into him sometime, because He was a Catholic, and when we moved out of Japan up into Korea, up to Taegu, this priest went with us. Now, let me say something. I had some old feelings about this. The Baptist, or the Methodist, or the Presbyterian, they didn't move up into the combat air force. They stayed in Japan. They'd fly over on Sunday and sing a few hymns, and then they'd go back. Now, the Catholic went up with us and stayed with us. Great big red-faced Irish, about 6 foot tall, and Father Ford. I don't mind breaking it, you know. Father Ford, up in combat, and we began to lose all these pilots, and I'd make no what faith you were. If you got killed, then we'd have mass for you the next day. He would. Down there, mass for it. And I began to drink an awful lot of liquor, and I began to hemorrhage a lot from the nose and fly so much altitude. And I told Father Ford, I said, flight surgeon's going to send me back to Nagoya to be operated on, because I'm hemorrhaging from the nose, bleeding, feeling my mask up. Do you know anybody in Nagoya when I get over there and get somebody to bring me some liquor once I get in the hospital? He says, Collins, I don't know anybody in Nagoya. I said, would you call and see if I could get somebody to bring me some liquor once I get in that hospital and operate on? So he called over and got a Catholic priest on the phone, this general hospital in Nagoya. Told him, said, I'm sending Lieutenant Collins over to be operated on. Says he's a Baptist in a hopeless case. Don't try to convert him, but bring him some liquor once he gets in the hospital. So once I checked into this hospital, this major came in with a little cross about Catholic priest and brought me a fifth of Sigma Vio every day I was in the hospital. Now, y'all think about what I'm saying. I'm serious about this. If you'd waited on the Baptist or the Presbyterian or the Methodist to bring you a drink, you'd have went to hell and back. They'd have never brought you a drink of liquor. Now, the Catholics did, and I thank God for them today, because had I not gotten the liquor, I would have gone into DTs in a matter of 12 hours. I'd been on then almost for a year on a daily basis, drinking as much as 40 ounces a day. That's how much I was drinking and still able to function okay with it. Of course, most of you know in the end you can't handle that much, but in the long end I could. But he got those people to bring me liquor, and I drank. I was drunk all the time when I was in the hospital. Came out of the hospital, went back to Korea, and finished my tour. Came home. I had a son born while I was overseas, C.D. the third. And I got noted. The Red Cross notified me about his son being born, and the weather was bad that day, and I guess it cost the government $50,000. We shot all the anti-aircraft gun on the bases, drank up all the liquor, and everybody got in fights, tore the club up and everything up, celebrating the birth of my son in Statesboro, Georgia. I finished the tour. Came back home to see Ida and the children. Had the son born while I was there. I got back in San Francisco. I came back by boat rather than plane. I wanted to see if I could get off the liquor. Evidently, I knew I was in trouble. Because I wanted to see if I could turn it loose crossing the Pacific. But I didn't know what would happen on board the boat, so I took me 12 40-ounce jug of Seagram's Vio on board the boat with me coming back across. I was drunk all the way across the Pacific. So I got in San Francisco, I called Ida and told her I was coming home. So she and the two little girls met me at Savannah, Georgia, left the little boy with her sister. I left the States weighing 127 pounds. I now weighed 185 pounds. I had a great big handlebar mustache, curled right up under my eyes. I drank so much liquor, I don't want y'all to say, I had bloated. I'd swell up like a frog. I could look straight out and see my cheeks. And when I got off the airplane, Ida didn't recognize me. I told her who I was. And when she found out who I was, the girl didn't recognize her dad either, you know. Nobody recognized her. I went out with 185 pounds, and I left weighing 127. And they didn't want to kiss me, and that hurt my feelings. So on the way home, I stopped and got a fifth of liquor. And I was drunk the first time I laid eyes on my son, Stevie the third. We moved back to Atlanta, Georgia, and moved out here to Mayretta. Our office then moved over into the old Bell Building, where they're building airplanes now. We had moved over there. Veterans Administration did, and I worked over there. Live right here in Mayretta. Went back to work over there. And Ida and I began to have a lot of problems. And the kind of problem I'm talking about doesn't make good telling. If I told it the way it was, all y'all get up and leave. You couldn't handle it. You say, I can't handle it. Let me out of here. I don't want to talk about it. We began to have an awful lot of trouble. Ida and I did. The kind of trouble doesn't make good telling. But it got to the point that Ida could no longer tolerate the situation. So she says, I don't know anything about it because I wasn't even conscious of what was going on. I went to work every day. I went to work with a drink in my hand. I could drink in the office. I hope none of y'all worked for the government. I did. I worked in the legal profession for them. And they had a bunch of real old lawyers and young lawyers that couldn't get a job. That's what they had in there. You know, old ones that were drunks that couldn't get a, you know, that's the only place they could work. And they had a bunch of young ones that couldn't get a job. And that's where I worked. But they had an ironclad rule over there with the government. If you fell out of your chair, they fired you. You know. And, we had a guy fall out of the chair one day and they fired him. Never forget as long as I live. He's one of the best lawyers we had. But what I'd do, I'd kind of lock in that chair, but I'd get in, sit down, and lock, hang there, you know, all day. I could drink liquor, but I could not fall out of that chair, you know. And they'd come by and think about it. And I don't know if y'all in the legal profession or not. They'd come by and ask you, what are you doing? What are you doing, Collins? I said, thinking. Thinking about cases. They'd come by, we'd let one, I'm still thinking about a case right there, you know. It's the greatest job in the world. You don't have to do nothing. You sit and think, you know, whatever. But Island was beginning to have a lot of trouble with me, so she decided to help me leave me, so she went to Statesboro, Georgia, and filed for divorce and divorced me. I was having a lot of trouble in Atlanta, Georgia, so I elected to leave Atlanta and go over to Birmingham, Alabama, with Social Security, and go to work with them. Got over to Birmingham. Right across from the Social Security office is Social Grill in Birmingham. Some of y'all may know where that is. Ran by Louis the Greek. And they sold liquor over in this restaurant. You could get miniatures in there, up to a half a pint in restaurants in Alabama. Now, they didn't have that law in Georgia. I don't know what they got now, but they didn't have that kind of law in Georgia. You could go in there. So when I got over there, I went up by to see Louis, and I told Louis who I was, and I told him I was coming to work with the government as lawyer. I said, I'm going to need some credit because my wife has all my funds tied up. There wasn't any fun, but I told Louis there was. He said, certainly, Mr. Cunningham, whatever you want. So I had a deal worked out with Louis and his waitress. I tipped all of them when I first got over. Every time I wanted to wait on them, I'd give them a dollar, and that's when a dollar was somebody. But I had a deal with these waitresses where they'd come by every morning. At that 10 o'clock break, at all government employees get, we'd all go over and lawyers and sit around this big round table and drink coffee. They'd put me a double shot of bourbon in that coffee cup, set the cream on the side, and put a spoon on it. And the only thing about this type of deal is you got to remember to blow it like it's hot. You got to say, and sip it like it's hot, you know, like you drink coffee. Because you don't want the rest of them know you're drinking straight liquor. So I'd get a drink at 10 o'clock in the morning, another at 12, another at 3 in the afternoon, and that's the way I'd get through the day. I started charging liquor at Louis. And at the end of 9 months, I owed Louis over $1,000 for half a pint of Seagram's Bill that I got in little miniatures. And I had a hell of a time paying it. I believe, I don't know about y'all in my own particular life, God intervened in my life. I joined the church as a young man. I'm not trying to preach religion or whatever, but I believe God intervened in my life because he began to try to get my attention. That's the way most of us get you. You got to get our attention some way or another. Things begin to happen to C.D. Collins. I was over in Birmingham, Alabama, sitting in the office one day, and two men come in, dressed up real nice, told my secretary, said, we'd like to see Mr. Collins, and so she brought them back, and they introduced themselves, said who they were. Said, would you ride downtown with us? I said, I'll be glad to. I told my secretary, I said, evidently they got some case down in the local office they want me to look at. So I'll go down to them. We got in this plain black Ford and drove downtown in the middle of Birmingham, Alabama, and pulled up in front of this huge gray building. We all got out of the car. I got out of the car and looked right above the door. This huge gray building says, Birmingham Jail. And I screamed like a stuck hog. And the guy picked me up and walked right in the door of the Birmingham Jail with me. I know none of y'all have ever been locked up, but let me tell you something about being locked up. It's one of the most impressive things I think can happen to you. It gets your attention, you know. They put me in a bullpen back there with about 150 guys. Locked the door. Let me tell you the first questions they ask you when the jailer walks off. Boy, what are you in for? I said, the warrant said child support. I said, Judge Smith will give you 5 years of hard labor for that. I'd like to die right in that cell. I could see myself on the chain gang in Birmingham, Alabama. A professional bondsman came down and bailed me out. I never did go back to my office. Called my dad in Atlanta, Georgia. He came and got me. Brought me home to mom and daddy. I was in Statesboro, Georgia with three small children trying to live, and I'm in Atlanta, Georgia with mom and daddy. Now, mama always said the reason I drank liquor was because I live with Ida. I said anybody who lived with Ida would have to drink. But I don't have Ida now. And I go back to mom and daddy, and it didn't take mama but about a week or two to find out what she had. And every one of y'all been through this, I guarantee you. You're in one room coming to, and you hear him in the next room talking about you. My mama called my daddy up. He went by Clifford, and I was Douglas, and then we just named everybody for CD anyway. She said, Clifford, I want you to load him up in that car and carry him down to Statesboro, Georgia, and whatever it takes, you get Ida to take him back. Because she's the only damn one mean enough to live with, you know. So my daddy loaded me up in his car and took me down to Statesboro, Georgia to see this lady right away on my left. And when she saw me, it was like pouring turpentine on a cat. Now, you have to be in South Georgia to understand that remark. She got to jumping up and down, bouncing around in the dining room, cussing. And she had some words I never had even heard, you know. And she was telling my daddy what kind of individual I was with a lot of adjectives that she would describe me with, you know. And some of it I never had even heard. I said, where did you hear that? She said, I thought it up to call you. That went on for days, me and I having to meet with my daddy. Finally, it came down. Now, you women, I don't hurt any of y'all's feelings. Come down to a money transaction. I think money talks with women most of the time. Now, you men may agree, but I hope you do, some of you anyway. Money talk. It come down to my daddy agreed to pay out in cold cash money to remarry me. She still said, well, he didn't pay me enough. She said, I'm right on that. Well, he didn't pay me enough, you know. She could. She told my dad, said, I'll remarry, but I ain't got a damn bit of use for him. Now, she told my dad, and he sat there, you know, I ain't got a bit of use for him, but I'll remarry. You know, if you'll furnish the money, okay. So that's my dad agreed to do it, and so we remarried. In the Baptist church at Belmont. Saturday, you ever seen a woman come down now with three children following her? You know?
Little boy kept saying, Mama, what's going on? Mama, what's going on? Trying to explain to him what's happening. So we remarried in that Baptist church. Went on a short honeymoon. Going out to Savannah, Georgia, trying to get reacquainted. And let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, what I did to this lady. We talked about my drinking. That was a problem the whole time. We talked about it very seriously. And I told her, I said, don't ever mention the word liquor to me again as long as you live. I never want to hear the word. I'll never take a drink as long as I live. And don't even mention it to me. So we remarried and got in the car and headed out for Savannah, 55 miles away. Got about 8 miles out of town. I began to think. Any of y'all ever think any? I began to think. So I turned to this lady and I said, listen, since we're remarried and I'm never going to drink again, wouldn't it be hard if we had a drink today? And she said yes, because she was wanting one herself too, you know. So we stopped and got a fifth of liquor and both got drunk. How about that? Hadn't been married 6 hours before we were both drunk. Came back home, very embarrassed about the whole deal, ashamed about what happened. Said we'll never drink again. We did not drink for a few short weeks. Started back again. Picked up again on this stuff. Went to work with the Department of Transportation, where I later retired from. Went to work with them, cutting grass and driving stakes. Lucky to have a job of any kind. Thank God for this, I do. Thank God for the way it happened to me. I began to do this on a daily basis. Tried to stay sober, was unable to do it. Started back drinking, looking, and everything went to hell wide open. Most of y'all can remember when things go down real fast. When you get towards the end in alcoholism, it goes fast. There's no lingering around with. And I thank God again for this. Mine went fast. When I started back, I wound up in a world of trouble real fast. I began to give bad checks for liquor, charge liquor, do anything in order to continue to drink. I don't know about you, but once I start drinking, I will do anything in order to continue. I don't care what it is. It doesn't make any difference what it is. Once I put a drink in the system, I'll do it. So I began to do everything in the world. I began to have a lot of trouble. And I began to have a lot of trouble. And I began to have a lot of problems with it. The bad checks, the charging, the liquor, and all that. And that's when I got on syrup liquor. Somebody told me, said, be sure and tell them about syrup liquor. I got on syrup liquor. It's over on the Geechee River at Rocky Ford. Farmers make corn buck. They take corn buck and they put cane syrup in the corn buck and distill it. And that comes out as syrup liquor. Because if a farmer's buying 2 tons of sugar a month, then the revenues, they pick up real quick. Hey, this guy's buying 2 tons of sugar, so he's making liquor. They know just like that, you're making liquor, and they go out and catch it. So they begin to put this cane syrup into the corn buck and distill it, and it comes out as syrup liquor. Every now and then, one of these meetings, I run in, the guy say, yeah, I tried something. Let me tell you about syrup liquor. It has a very unique smell about it. You can smell it for a half mile. If you're ever in South Georgia in summertime, and you see a guy on the side of the road doing this, he's on syrup liquor because the yellow jackets are swarming right around his head, you know. He's beating and framing all the time. And they won't bite you. You know, he lies in the tongue, you spit him out. He ain't gonna bite you. You just spit him out because he wants some of that stuff too. And I got on this stuff. It's $4 a gallon. I established credit over at Rocky Ford where I bought it this honest government. And the smell, though, is so bad that if you sleep on a mattress, you gotta throw the mattress away. You never get odor out. If you stay in the room very much, you can't get it out. This is when I'd elected to move me out of the house in the back porch. In the closet. Now, she said it's a bedroom. Well, no bedroom. It's a closet. Wasn't my twice big as this thing. And had one little window by it big. Had a little bub that hung down on a string, a 40-foot bub, and she put me in this closet back to come off these drunks. And I'd have a gallon of liquor laying back in that dump. That little 40-foot bub. And the only way to do that, I'd have a Wild West book in the lap. And I'd be on the same page 4 days later. Never turn my eye, just looking at it. We had a lady who was looking after the children. She'd come around peeping the window. I don't know why they never would look in. Oh, she'd come around peeping the window and see if I was breathing. I'm asking the medical profession about it. I've had a lot to do with the medical profession. So what is it? And y'all think about it. Some of you guys that are bad drunk, now think about it. You've been on drunk for a week or two, and you're so near dead, you don't have to breathe very often. You ever notice that? You can wait a while, you know? Just wait a while, you know? And they say to peep through the window, she'd, you know, look for sometimes 10 or 15 minutes, she'd see no movement. She'd get all excited. She'd run and call out and say, he's dead today, you know? I said, don't worry about it. I'll check on when I get home. So when I'd get home, they'd both come around and peep in this window to see if I was breathing. And I'd say, sometime they'd look, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And she'd get very hopeful. Maybe he is dead, you know. And Rex, she'd see a slight movement in the stomach. She said, that SOB's not dead. Maybe he'll be dead tonight, you know. Very hopeful about the whole deal. And this is the way things were with us in the end, the way it was without an eye. To describe what went on when I'd see my children, I'd be laying on the floor and I'd come to. And I used to tell this and cry like a baby in the beginning. Everybody else would cry too, and I don't tell that way anymore. I'd open my eyes, and my two little daughters come walking by, and I'd see those worn-out shoes and those tattered dresses those kids had on. And you know what? I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live with it. I'd have to get up off the floor and go get more liquor wherever. I'd have to get up and get more liquor because the only peace I had anymore was total oblivion in the end. I don't want y'all ever went that far. Oblivion is what I was looking for. No fun, no euphoria anymore. Oblivion is all I thought. And then I could take a half a pint and take two swallows out of it. Fall to sake, shot more than that. Lay for 2 or 3 hours. Wake up, take another shot. Go out again. In the end, that's what it took. Just to swallow. I could take a half pint and stay drunk 24 hours on a half pint of liquor. That's the way things were. And I wanted out, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted out bad. I and I talked about it. We had a lot of things that happened in the home at that time. It was very, very dangerous. Could have been fatal to a lot of people. Thank God again that he smiled on us. But I wanted out, and she's read about a place in Atlanta, Georgia, that you could go to for treatment in the Georgia Alcoholic Clinic on Briarcliff Road, ran by Dr. Vernell Fox. And I tell you her name because she was a beautiful lady. Anyway, I told her I wanted to go. I see a man nodding. Said, I said, I want to go to this place. I don't care what it costs, nothing else. I want to get in. So she called up and they told him to bring me up. And she didn't have a way to bring me. So my mother and sister came down to Statesboro, Georgia, and got me. On a Sunday, and it was so bad, all the liquor store was closed, and I was in such bad shape, they stopped in Swainsboro and got a guy to open a liquor store there on Sunday and get me a fifth of liquor so I could make the trip back to Atlanta to try to get in this treatment place. And let me say here now, I didn't know what they did in treatment. I didn't know where to put you in, you know, maybe padded cells, squirted water on, and beat you with holes, you know. I didn't know what to do. I didn't care. I just wanted out. And I came up and went in this place. And I never will forget this one. I got in the place, I called it. State Highway Department and told them where I was. You know what they informed me back? I called head of personnel. I said, this is C.D. Collins. I'm in treatment. Drinking. Liquor trouble. I said, Mr. Collins, you're fired. That's what they told me over the phone. I elected to stay there and go through, and I thank God again because I'd gone so far I would have been unable to walk in AA off the streets and stay sober. I went through this treatment center there. For the first time in my life, I was stopped cold. I was stopped for the first time in my life and was able to look at C.D. Collins. Find out who this guy is, what did he want out of life, what kind of individual he was, and the whole bit. They didn't give you any kind of medication at all. And I slept with a boy, and I'll throw this out because the guy is dead now. I slept with a boy by the name of Sandy Sanderson that was in the room with me out of bed. That every day the staff made a report on you there. They made a report whether or not they thought you'd make it. They gave Sandy a favorable report every day. When the staff met, they evaluated everybody in the place. They thought he would stay sober. C.D. Collins, no. I had too many problems. To make a long story short, after we come out of treatment, Sandy was dead in 6 months. He went to Thomasville, Georgia, was writing that paper down there. He covered the Nuremberg trials in Germany. Brilliant writer. But he was dead in 6 months. I come home. Ida didn't want me to come home. She told me not to come back to Statesboro, Georgia. Stay in Atlanta, my mother and daddy. But I went home anyway. That's for a selfish reason. I went home to see if I could stay sober. See if I could be a decent father and a husband. I had to stay in the basement of the hotel when I got there. Paid $5 a week for a room. I never will forget that as long as I live. I caught a ride back to work. Got my job back cutting grass with the highway department. And I go back to that. To the highway every day at work. And they told me to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. AA was started in Statesboro, Georgia by an Al-Anon. Let me say, now Al-Anon got AA started in Statesboro, Georgia. And we were invited to attend the first meeting. That ought to tell you something. Somebody invites you to attend the first meeting of AA. But you've got some kind of problem, you know. With it. So they invited us to go to the first meeting. And we went. And we've been there ever since. And let me tell you a little bit about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me today. I don't know about you out there, and I hope, God, if you're new in the program, for God's sake, stick with us. Stick in you and hang in you. Because what I was told at the first speaker I've heard speak it, in Augusta, Georgia, 1958, a man by the name of Tom Power from Chapel Hill, New York, said the program will work under all conditions. It's guaranteed to work under all conditions. You can lose your health, your wealth, your wife, you can use everything in the world, but if you work the program on a daily basis to the best of your ability, you will not drink liquor. You may be miserable, that's okay. And I found the guy who told me the truth, and I've held on to that for these years. Because if you've been sober almost 34 years like I have now, you'll have problems in the family. We've had death in the family, money trouble, job trouble, child trouble. We've had it all since sobering up. I've never entertained the idea of taking a drink of liquor. I believe I'll go get drunk. It's never occurred to me. Never. I've done an awful lot of prayer. A lot of prayer and asked a lot of people to pray for me. I don't know y'all ever done that. Not I have. I have. I still do today. If I get in trouble and I can't get no relief from praying myself, I'll ask you and you and you. And they say, hey, pray for me. Said, when? I said, now. You know, I'm in bed. He talk. Pray now. I've used that many, many times. For God's sakes, if you ever get in a bind where you think you can't make it, ask your friends to pray for you. I've asked it many times and it worked for me. So do that because it worked, ladies and gentlemen. And the freedom it's given me by being in AA, the freedom that I've gotten from being sober is one of the greatest freedoms in the world. I don't know how y'all feel about it. I'm as good as anybody in the world. I can look you straight, I'm as good as you are. I'm not any better, but I'm as good as you. I can walk down the streets of any town. I can walk in the bank just like I got money in it now. You know, old deal. I feel good about old. And I go to church and Sunday school every Sunday. After Al and I had been sober for 5 years, we had an epidemic in the club. And there's about 8 or 10 women in the club in Al-Anon. Had an epidemic in the club. John Moon said he thought it was a water. We never could find out what caused it. But all these women come up pregnant. And I'd have come up pregnant. And we like to die. We didn't know what in the world we were going to do. We were in debt. Right here, had one girl who was a sophomore in college, the other senior in high school, and the boys in eighth grade, Douglas. It's in eighth grade. And she gets pregnant. That'll test whether or not you got the AA program, let me tell you right now. That'll test it. You can stay sober under those conditions, you got it, because I didn't see any way to live. Yet I'd have had another baby, and the day the baby was born, there were 22 members of Alcoholics Anonymous standing outside the living room, and they brought him out. Said, here he is, look at him, still wet. And I'd have gave him to me. Said, now you got one, I've had three, you got you one. And I got to bathe him and to burp him and wipe his fanny and do the whole bit. I wouldn't take $1 million for a day because I love him better than anything in the world. The only one I ever got to do that with today, ladies and gentlemen. God's sakes, if you got small children or greater, enjoy it. I got to do it all with this kid. I rock him till he's 13 years old and rock him till I pick him up. Try to get him back to bed, you know, he's bigger than I was. And I love him today better than anything. I don't know, I've had a lot of problems, and as I told you, kind of problem I'm talking about, a lot of, we begin to have an awful lot of problems in the home. Had four children, two of them are alcoholics, and those two are in the program sober today. And let me tell you one thing, when I gave my son his white chip, I made this statement, I wouldn't take $1 million cash for what I'm doing. I don't know whether he stay sober or not, but I wouldn't take $1 million if I gave him a white chip. He's still sober today. He went back to school on his own. I kept him in school about 4 or 5 years. He just had all kind of trouble. He went back on his own. Paid for his own way. He got finished college. He's in business today doing heck of a good job. He's in church and Sunday school every Sunday. And he'll put his arm around his dad and say, hey, Daddy, I love you. Hey, Daddy, I love you. And let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. What I've found in the AA program has meant more to me than anything else. Now, this is, I don't say anything that makes any sense. Listen to this. I have found the real meaning of the word L-O-V-E, love. It's the most used and misused and abused word in the English language today, the word love. Abused, used, and abused because we love our dog, we love our cat, we love our car, we love, yeah. But in the AA program, I found the real meaning of love. It's love of one human being for another without asking anything back. Whether you love me or not, lady, I love you. I hope you understand where I'm coming. That's what I found in the AA program, the word of love. It has nothing to do with race, creed, or color. Some of the finest people, well, I know we got a bunch of blacks in our group. Love them very dearly. Outstanding AA members. I wouldn't take anything away from our relationship today. And let me tell you one thing. I'm going to close up because I never talk over an hour. And I think y'all have talked about 45 minutes now. Never talk too long. Let me tell you what AA means to me again. It means this to me. When I die, and I'm at the evening of my life now, I know that without any doubt about it, somebody walk by the casket and say, C.D. Collins tried to help his fellow man. That's the highest compliment you can pay a human being. C.D. tried to help his fellow man while he was here. And I'd rather they say that about me than be governor of the state of Georgia. And I wanted to be governor. A young man could have been governor. I think I'd have been better than some of them anyway. But I was what I wanted to be, you know, and could have been. But I wouldn't change places with the governor of the state of Georgia today. Now, y'all might think, well, I'm crazy. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Because anywhere in the world I go today, and I go everywhere out, and I do, I'm accepted wherever I go. I say, hey, my name's C.D. I'm an alcoholic. Come in. They don't nobody ask me if I'm a Rotarian or you're a Sigma Chi or you're a lawyer. They don't nobody ask me nothing. Come in, C.D. We're glad to have you. Where would you find that? Nowhere. In any other fellowship organization in the world, you cannot find that. Nowhere. Where you accept it. Hey, I'm an alcoholic. Come in. And I do not travel the length and breadth of this country. And we've been accepted everywhere we go. We have people who come up and hug my neck and say, hey, C.D., I love you. And I thank God for that because you have that ability to do that to me. You make me feel good. I'm glad I'm a part of this wonderful fellowship. And I'm glad I can try to pass on a message to you out there because it's the greatest freedom in the world is to be sober. To be chemically free and sober where you can walk down the streets and you're okay with me. I go to church and Sunday school. I try to help my fellow man. I still do the same day today I did 34 years ago. I still mop the floor in the club room. I make the coffee. I pull chairmanship just like I did 34 years ago. Somebody said, one time you're a circuit speaker. I said, no, I'm not a circuit speaker. I don't know why anybody wants to hear me, really. Still don't understand that today. The only reason I'm up here talking is the reason I was asked to talk, and that's the reason I'm here. And so don't ever call Stevie and ask me to come if you don't want me to, because I will come, you know, okay? That's the way that's the game I play out, and I do. And we've done it. And the woman that hated and despised him was going to blow my brains out, would have one time, particularly as loves the ground I walk on, I love her. We ride down the road a lot of times, she's sitting next to me, and we're holding hands. Everybody said, I bet that's not that old goat's wife, but it is. That's my wife that's sitting next to me, and I'm holding her hand. I like that. She's a good-looking lady, and I love her very dearly. And we have a special relationship, and if you don't, for God's sakes, get one. With your husband, your children, or whoever, your mother, father, whatever. This woman and I talk open and honest with each other about whatever. We tell each other the truth, and we express it in a feeling deal. I feel like you're not being fair to me. I feel like, you know, you're not doing your part. I feel like you're spending the money. I feel like whatever. I feel like throwing you through the wall, but I don't throw her through the wall. I felt like it, you know. But I've had, and we're able to talk to each other, open and honest about what you're going to change the whole picture in our relationship. Because we know if we ask each other a question, we're going to get the answer back. Another thing you can't read anybody's mind. I used to think I could read her mind. I know what you think. She said, no, hell, you know, yes, I do. You can't read anybody's mind. All you know is they tell you. And I found out through this program, you know, that you can tell each other the truth and you can accept it and handle it today. I don't know, it's different than daylight and dark. When I retired, I lost my commission in the Air Force. But I ain't got up, I forgot somebody. I lost my commission out here flying drunk one Sunday in a T-33 jet in 1954. I took a lady at one Sunday, me and her both drunk. And I couldn't even sign the clearance, and they got stirred about it because I couldn't sign my name. So they turned over to Colonel Wilton, who later made general. Some of y'all may remember him real well. He called me and asked me, was that my clearance? I said, yes. He said, were you drinking? I said, yes, sir, I was drinking. He said, yeah, you can't drink and fly my airplane. I said, well, I flew 100 missions drinking. I don't know why I can't fly yours. He said, not mine. I said, I'm going to court-martial you. I said, since you've been in two wars, I'll let you resign your commission. So they let me resign. I lost my commission in the Air Force. I got sober like all alcoholics. I got sober, and I want everything back, and I want to be a decent human being again. I want to fly again for the military, and I applied to get back in, and they turned me down as a security risk. I went to Washington, D.C., went out to Pentagon, talked to them. Talked to General Cantwell, a four-star general, told him my story. He said, go back and reapply, Mr. Collins. I come back and reapplied. They let me back in the military, and I flew for another 16 years for them, flew helicopters and in. And today, I want to pass this on sometime, but today I have an acrobatic airplane, fully acrobatic, has inverted fuel, inverted oil, symmetrical wing, and I fly upside down old town a lot. They get all upset. Police take pictures and all this stuff, and here a while back they had a petition up that you're going to take me into federal court. And they didn't know that I was teaching the federal judge how to do acrobatics at the time, so I don't have any problem with it. I tell you that, not bragging on, but I enjoy that. Now, I won't fly acrobatics with me anymore, but I take a lot of young people up, a lot of people who enjoy that, because I can do it all. I taught it. And I like to fly upside down and do all that funny stuff. It's a lot of fun. And I take people up and do that a lot. So if any of y'all ever down to Statesboro, Georgia, and you see them, yeah, I did the mall, you see me late down about 5 o'clock, I put on the show. You see this airplane got red, white, and blue, got big stars on it. And you see it come over upside down, begin to roll it, and then loop it, and do Cuban eights and all this stuff. Who is that? That's old C.D. Collins. Don't worry about it, okay? Thank y'all for listening to me. I've enjoyed it very much, and it's an honor to be here and be a part of it, and I'm going to enjoy the rest of this deal now. My mouth has been dry, and I felt like I'm not conveying what I need to convey to you, but for God's sakes, hang in here, because it is a way of life, and it will blow your mind as to what will happen to you if you stay sober and work the program to the best of your ability on a daily basis. It'll blow your mind. Thank you very much.